Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her novel, Simple. Kathleen George is the author of The Odds, which was nominated in 2010 for the Edgar for Best Novel. She is also editor of the short story collection, Pittsburgh Noir. A professor of theater at the University of Pittsburgh, she and her husband live in Pittsburgh. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to Prosody.
Thank you. Hi, Ellen.
How about we start tonight with you reading from Simple?
Okay. This is from the very beginning of Simple.
Great.
They are in his office, the door locked. He has an eye on the clock because if she stays for a long time, people will talk. She comes in farther, looking about again as if to memorize the furniture, though this is not the first time he summoned her. He has a sofa in there, comfortable chairs. He gestures her toward the sofa. It's been an exhausting day. He throws up a hand awkwardly. She smiles. Sit for just a minute, he says. He rubs his hands over his eyes and sits on the sofa next to her. I worry about too many things, and I'm not sure worry does any good at all. You remind me of a saint, she says. Well, no, not at all. I'm not sure I'm flattered. You look kind of holy. I'm not sure what it is. Long face, eyes a little moist. She laughed then. Well, you don't seem very taken with me. Oh, I am, though. And that's what he was waiting to hear. But after she said it, and lightly, as if teasing, she slumped, defeated. Then he said, as if breathing and brushing it aside, he said, I am too. I mean, there's a lot of something in the air between us. I don't want to act on it. Oh, I know, she said. She glanced at the picture of his wife and two sons on the desk and then quickly averted her eyes. I'm pretty mixed up. I mean, I never had this experience of feeling close to someone who was married. It goes against everything, so I fight it. He said something like, I wouldn't put you through the midlife mess. He went to his desk and picked up a folder of information he'd assembled for her about a charitable work with the local hospital. For years, he'd coordinated ways for big businesses to present gifts of magazines and flowers and toys to those who needed comfort. Here, he said, you'll see how I did it. He handed her the folder, sat down, and met her eyes. My wife and I are separated. We live in the same house, but not, you know, together. We have to stay together because of the election, so my handlers tell me. For some reason, he added, he knew to add, she's seeing someone. I have to put up with it, and of course that's tough. Oh, no, you mean has it been for a long time now? Long enough. He sat next to her again and began rolling the manila folder instead of handing it over. She wore a simple brown dress that crossed over, a wraparound. He remembered his wife describing that kind of dress once, so he knew the name. It was meant to be modest, but on her, it wasn't. She was a creature with bedroom eyes, bedroom mouth. Is that what he couldn't stop thinking about? Or was it the way she carried herself, intensely alert? Or the surprise of her laugh? Or plain need in him for adoration, the adoration she provided? He wanted to see her relax. There was that, too. He handed over the folder. She took it, closed her eyes, and then opened them wide to look straight at him. Don't care about me, he said. Don't. You have boyfriends? Plural. That would be something. I don't even have one. And why not? I never like anybody enough. Why not? I just don't. He leaned over and kissed her. The promise in her eyes and mouth was true. She was a sensual creature. Her family, she told him, was very religious. She'd had a strict upbringing and was even homeschooled for a time. Oh, my God, she said. Oh, my God, I wanted this. I thought about you that way. And now here I am, and I don't know what to do. Do? She started to cry. I'm stupid, as bad as Monica Lewinsky, falling in love with the wrong person. You could make purses afterwards, he teased. That's a little section from the beginning of Simple.
Great. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her novel, Simple. Kathleen, one of the things I was wondering, I mean, this is, how many books is this for you now? Published five?
This is six.
Six?
Number six.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good for you. One more than I thought. And I was thinking in terms of the structure of all of it, you know, now that You've had characters that you've worked with for a really long period of time. You've kind of worked with the crime mystery form for a while. As a writer, do you know what's going to happen? Like, is everything mapped out for you ahead of time? Because I know a number of writers who write fiction, kind of their characters will do things they don't expect, like partway through the writing, and they'll go, oh, look at that. Do you still get that within your writing, the ability to do that, or do you really have to kind of be wrestling those characters into what you need them to do?
I still get that. It's very inefficient in a way. Some of the writers that I know who are able to write really, really fast outline everything, and they make everything happen according to the outline. But I allow things to experimentally evolve. And when you do that, you sometimes have to say, well, that was a wrong turn. I have to throw that away. I have to try something else here. That scene isn't working. And so it takes a little longer.
Sure. And then do you find between the books, because you're working with characters, I'm guessing that some of that writing that you're doing that maybe might not be efficient for a particular book just helps you get to know those characters better, or maybe might show up in another story or another novel? Or
that's true. Outtakes are kind of valuable, so you just sort of keep them in a file.
Yeah. In your compost heap. Yeah. You're becoming right. Like a detective. You're keeping a file on people.
Right, exactly.
There was something else I'm curious about in terms of the form, and that has to do with the use of omniscient point of view. Third-person omniscient. So that means you get to get in everybody's head. The readers get to get in everybody's head as well. And, you know, it's not really a point of view that you see a lot of. It used to be really prevalent. You know, people kind of equate it with things like Dickens and you know, those Victorian novels. What do you like about that point of view, and what don't you like about that point of view in terms of your writing?
Well, I've always wondered with admiration how people sustain a first person for 400 pages or whatever, because that's a lot of being on stage for a long time. And I would say that as a theater person, I was always a director and not an actor. In fact, really not an actor. So my comfort was in giving everybody an inner life, and working with all of the actors so that they had a lot of inner monologue going on and they knew the whole story from the inside. And I liked that. I really liked doing it. And then when I began writing, I found I was the most comfortable with that too, and not the actor's position, which is more first person.
Sure.
More staying on stage the whole time. And that's sort of daunting to me.
And so then when I think about that and then trying to write dialogue, right, for a bunch of different characters, and so having that kind of cohesive view that the third person allows, but then also trying to interject those first person, how do you kind of write a character's voice for a while until you feel them, or are they always kind of in a scene and you see what they sound like as they're interacting with each other?
It's more that they're in a scene and I find out what they sound like. I think I hear voices actually pretty well, or perhaps not. Maybe I just hear voices. I don't know. That's the part that comes very easily to me, is dialogue. Once I tune in that third person attached point of view to where the character is, what they're thinking, what they're feeling, I kind of know how they're going to speak.
Sure. I think that's great. You hear voices. You might not want to tell everybody you meet.
I'll tell everybody.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her novel, Simple. Kathleen, will you read some more for us?
I'd be happy to. I'm going to skip ahead. You can guess that in that office they began kissing and moving towards each other and didn't know what they were going to do. And then the thing in the air between them continued. They subsisted on the idea of it for almost a month before they did anything serious about it. At the office, her assignments were not always about the political part of his life, but included other aspects of the firm's business and some of his charitable work. She was interested in everything. That was in May. So, space jump, and we move to in August, the party organizer came to him as he did at least once a week to jaw about the progress they were making. They sat in his office, him on the sofa, Todd Simon on the chair in front of the sofa. Todd spread out a map of the state on the small coffee table between them. He explained which districts were coming along and which ones weren't, which local party chairmen were likely on board and which were difficult. "We don't have a long time," he said. "We need more bucks, and you're going to have to lean on a few of your friends." He pulled out and lit up a cigarette, even though he knew Michael Connelly hated smoke. "I can't raise the bulk of it on my end. I can only do my thing." "Right. You'll get on these friends in the next 2 weeks?" "Yes, I will." Simon unearthed an ugly plastic ashtray from his briefcase, one that had some logo on it and notches for 3 cigarettes. He blew smoke in the direction of the door, away from Connelly. Then all of a sudden, Simon said, "How many women in your life, currently?" "What do you mean?" "Don't be dumb. I'm told you mess around or have. We're at a crucial juncture. You want to tell me anything?"
"No."
"Well, who are the current squeezes?"
"You don't need to know that."
"I sure do. Believe me, there are people looking to find out."
"Who?"
"The press, donkeys, my bosses."
"I'm very careful. Tell me. Let's start with the current."
He stared out the window for a long time. He supposed he would always feel there was a camera on his every move. "There's a young, one of the paralegals here, and 6 months ago, one of my wife's friends." Simon laughed.
"Some friend, that's it?"
"Yes."
"And in the more distant past?"
"You don't need that."
"Yes, I do."
"Okay, a woman who used to be in the firm."
"She could be trouble."
"No, she's married, lives in Dallas. She's content with her life."
"How do they leave you when they leave you?"
"They leave me happy. I'm nice."
"Who else?"
"A woman I met at a fundraiser about 10 years ago."
"And where is she?"
"Somewhere in the city. I ran into her, say, 3 years ago, and she was all friendly, no grudges."
"You must do and say the right things. How many more?"
"A couple."
"You don't look the type, which is good, I guess."
"What does that mean?"
"You look like a guy who wouldn't."
Connelly gave names and addresses. It galled him.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her novel, Simple. So you've chosen to publish a novel about politics in a year when politics is everywhere, right?
Front, I know, and center. Yes.
So I just want to ask about that. Was that just, you know, was it that the rhetoric that's out there kind of seeped in? I mean, obviously you work in advance of the publication. Or did you want to have a book that had a politician as a lead character kind of in the mix when we're in a political year?
Well, you know, you write these things so far in advance of when they're published. So this was a couple of years ago, several years ago when I actually wrote it. And at the time, I was fascinated by all of the politicians in the news who were having affairs. And I thought, my God, it's practically every one of them. And people keep being shocked instead of saying, I'm not shocked. This is what happens, you know. And so what would be the story behind it? And how could I get, how could I investigate that story? I think the Chandra Levy case had had a big effect on me because the presumption of guilt was so great in that case. And there was another story altogether, and the police had botched it. And I found it just plain interesting.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, in terms of the characters, it is that... beyond it being a crime mystery, it's the idea of how far will somebody go in order to make sure that they get what they want. I mean, I think that's kind of a universal theme, but I think we see it play out more often with politicians, and I'm not saying all of them have affairs, but obviously they change their messages or they change their personality or they change their platforms, and it all seems to be at some point like, it's very revealing about character, which I think would be interesting for a writer.
Oh, yeah, it is very revealing. I think I'm fascinated by how people fool themselves or live two truths at the same time. And I'm sure so many politicians have said, I know this is dangerous, but it will be all right. I can handle it, you know. And, of course, when it all hits the news, right, they can't handle it.
Right. And then also the whole idea of, like, spinning messages. And all of that becomes kind of a
I mean, it almost feels like it's the small crimes around the big crime, and the layers that kind of add to the text.
I agree, absolutely.
Yeah. Can you read some more for us?
I'd be happy to.
Great.
We seem to be on a track of following what Todd Simon is doing to Mike Conley, so we'll do a little bit more of that. 4 days later, Simon was back. "You have four paralegals," he said. "I could have figured out which one, not a doubt in my mind. Without a name, I'd say she looks unreliable." This time, Simon didn't sit down. "What makes you say that?" "Emotional." That was true. She was emotional. "Guilty." That was true. He hated Simon. "Where do you see her?" "Motels." "Where?" 30 miles out, 60 miles out, 100. "Never the same one." "Who pays?" "I give her cash. She books the room." "You ever go to her house?" "Never." It occurred to him afterward that Simon had said house and not place or apartment. "That's good anyway. And your wife?" "We're okay. The usual stresses." "She knows?" "No." "Or like she's seeing somebody herself?" "No, she would never." "Well, it does happen. Sure?" "Absolutely. Why, are you telling me something different?" "No, no, no. This little girlfriend of yours, I watched her get into her car one day. She was crying. See, she was crying." What could he say? He'd seen the waterworks. They made him nervous, too. "Tell me," Simon said. "Remember, I'm on your side. You are our boy. A lot of people are putting up a lot of money on you. I need to know the worst." "Okay, once she said she was going to call my wife and suggest we all meet and hash it out." "Hash what? Who ends up with whom?" "So, she's completely nuts. She doesn't get it, does she? What's at stake for you? She doesn't get it." "Well, she's religious. She's upset. She needs to talk to somebody. I think she doesn't know how to put it together." "She thinks she's going to end up with you." "Yeah. And you? What do you want? You want that?" "No. No, I want to keep things as they are." A long whistle came out of Simon.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her novel, Simple. I want to shift conversation a little bit and talk about the readers in terms of, I'm wondering, as a writer of mysteries, if you feel any pressure to kind of add additional science or technology these days because of the kind of fascination with CSI programs and the whole kind of lab aspect of, you know, I think probably when crime mysteries first came out, it was really about the human and the detective and the, you know, the handkerchief that was caught in the doorway kind of thing, these small signals. And now it seems to be really, you know, science is a big part of it as well. So, you know, do you have to up your game that way when you're writing now?
I think you have to with regard to what computers can do. I'm always calling and asking about searches and how you do this and how you do that. I don't think about technology much. I think about it when I have to, when it comes to something I need to know about solving the crime. But in the case of this book, I actually had a technical, scientific thing presented to me by the policeman that I consult with. And he said, "I've got a great idea for something that would work in solving a crime." And I resisted it. I thought, no, I don't want to put that in. But then it worked on my brain, and I kept thinking about it and thinking about it, and I thought, finally, he's right. This would be a unique clue, unlike anything I've ever read before, so I used it. And so this has one technical matter that I'd never tried before, never would have thought of on my own.
Right, and we will leave that unnamed because it's critical to the book, so you'll have to
read the book
in order to figure out what that is. Talk a little bit about your research process. I know in this book people are incarcerated. I think you probably, before it was mainly you were working with detectives and police officers in their department, but this kind of led you to a new terrain. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I made an appointment to go to the Allegheny County Jail without committing a crime.
Yeah, I don't think usually you make an appointment to go there, so right. I think that's probably pretty accurate.
And I admit I've had the fantasy for a long time that there's never enough time to read and never enough time to write, and so if I ever were jailed,
I would have enough time to read and write. Well, when I got to the jail, I changed my mind about that because it smelled pretty bad and the noise level was very high. Everything was hard surfaces. And I thought, no, I really wouldn't like it very much after all.
It's but not like the library?
No, it's not. I got to go to a cell, and I wanted to see the general area or the pod where the inmates gathered. So it was a terrific visit, though. I was treated well, and they were showing me around. The captain there was showing me around. And only something happened when I was there. He put his key card in the door, and all the lights went, and the place went into lockdown.
Uh-oh.
Now, it didn't have anything to do with his key card. It was timing. But he was puzzled, and I'd never thought of a lockdown. Well, that made its way into my novel, believe me. It was sort of exciting, you know? Everybody had to go back to their cells. I never got to actually talk to any of the inmates because...
Did you want to? Was that supposed to be part of your
trip? Did want to, but mostly I wanted to watch them interacting with each other. I had to make that part up.
Sure. And then in terms of the environment, was it, you know, obviously you said it smelled different than you expected and it was louder than you thought. Did it look different than you anticipated? I guess I'm wondering if the depictions that we all think we have in our heads are accurate or not.
It was a bit more plastic than I had imagined. Everything was heavy plastic. The tables bolted to the floor and the chairs and there were big television sets up, and I realized they watched a lot of TV. And I asked what they watched, and it was a lot of sports. And so I have a scene in which they're watching sports. And
they're not watching CSI.
No, not at the moment anyway.
Could you read some more for us?
I'd be glad to.
Great.
It would be not one of my novels if I didn't put Commander Christie in there. So this book starts when he's away on vacation and on Cape Cod, and he gets the call, or he calls into the office, and he hears about the murder on the way back. In fact, he kind of asks a few questions about it and how they're going to proceed. And it's clear that he's already left Cape Cod a day early, saying it's the rain, but he's a worker. He wants to get back to work. So this is the section. Christie had felt his blood spike at the news of the murder, and he had the unmistakable wish to be there working the case. He tried to talk himself into letting it go to others on the squad who wanted and even needed the credit, because after all, he told himself driving along, he was officially still on vacation. Everybody needed a break. Coulson and McGranahan were good, not creaky like Nellens and Hrusnak. Marina watched him. He knew she was reading his thoughts. "Who's the victim?" she asked finally. "A young woman, a law student." "Sad. Hard case, easy case?" she asked. "Can't tell yet. I caught them just as they started for it." "You got vibrations," she said. He told Marina, tipping his head toward the back seat, where his daughter had been staring out the window, slack-jawed, and his son, who wore earbuds, nodded his head to something he was teaching himself to like. "I should go in tonight after I get them to their mother's house." She bit her tongue. "You have to work tonight?" Julie asked, coming alert. He wondered what kinds of things she thought about on the long drive. What did she notice? What did she see? Marina began arranging the things around her seat. She was always good for keeping paper towels, tissues, water, and treats handy. He knew she was thinking about his habit of hovering over the other detectives. It was a fault, yes, but he didn't feel like changing it. He picked up speed. Somehow he refrained from calling in to the office immediately again and, well, hovering. He counseled himself that it might be all over by the time he arrived. The rain had stopped. "It's nice now," Julie said. "We could have stayed." "Only to leave tomorrow morning when it was nice," he said. "That would have made us sad." Marina kept changing her position. It was hard being a passenger, not in control, and also not being able to move her body. She tried knees up to her chin. She tried crossing her legs. She felt tearful. Her husband hadn't liked Cape Cod, and she had. He didn't even understand what a coup it was to get a house for half the usual price in Truro, right on the beach. Absolutely fantastic. She'd snagged the house because she knew an actor who had an aunt who only rented to friends or relatives. She'd just spent 2 weeks in an amazing house, and she'd probably never get to go again. Richard was eager to get home. He was a good man, a good husband, and an accepting person. He wasn't so much uncomfortable on Cape Cod as bored. When they went into Provincetown, which they did twice, once on a rainy day to join the throngs on the crowded streets, he tolerated the happy gaze, the galleries, the tacky shops, the bumped umbrellas, leaking slickers, and thick crowds with as much good humor as he could manage. He said, "I wasn't meant for vacations. I like our backyard." They'd laughed companionably about his being a curmudgeon, but still, he wasn't romantic with her. He made love to her only twice in 2 weeks. And distractedly at that, she didn't know how to win him back. Sometimes she wasn't even sure she wanted to. Why couldn't she take off for a glorious place like the one she just left and enjoy it without worrying about him? She loved his kids, but she had more than occasional fantasies of a life without cereal and backpacks. She looked over at her husband and he said, "What?" And she said, "Nothing." He'd warned her at the start that they were different and that she would get bored with him. She was intellectual and an artist, creative on good days, effete on bad days. He always said he was a working-class drudge, more ordinary than dirt. Anxiety seized her heart. Boredom wasn't it. She wanted to be let in. She sighed deeply. Police wives were always second. Work was first. "Easy," he said, as if they'd been speaking. "My guess is no. They'll call most everybody in to work on this one because it's newsworthy, high profile."
There's a theme in the book about partnerships in lots of ways. I think Christy and Marina have been married for a while. The whole idea of partnerships within the police department, who, especially towards the end of the book, is the idea of who fits well with who, and kind of an underlying boredom, I think, or restlessness maybe. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit. I mean, these are characters you've known for a while now. And was that just something that... I guess I'm wondering, is it something they told you? Is it something you were feeling with them a little bit in terms of a writer to your characters?
No, they told me, and it all started when somebody suggested to me that I add a woman detective to the mix, which was a good suggestion. So Colleen Greer is now a major part of the detective squad, and she fell in love with Christy. I didn't tell her to. She just did. And so she fell in love with him, and he was married and dangerous, and so they had that kind of tension going all the time. And now her life is changing, and he kind of misses her. And I just let it happen. Whatever was going to happen between them seems to... It tells me, you're right, they tell me what's going on.
Yeah, it felt very human and very real. I think sometimes... particularly when there's a form that has kind of characters that operate in a particular way, that that human element gets stripped away. I think, you know, even if you're in a great relationship, sometimes you just kind of get bored with each other or somebody else draws your attention. And I thought that was a nice touch in the book that was happening besides all of the clues being picked up.
Oh, thank you.
So, well, our time is up.
Oh, thank you very much, Ellen.
Thanks for coming. You've been listening to Prosody, 90.5 WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Versed, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday at 6:30 for Prosody on Pittsburgh's NPR news station, 90.5 WESA.